Well, we're on the air. Henry?
Air? We're not on the air.
Well,
on the platter.
Let's call it hot air.
Yeah,
That's right. I'm a little confused after that ride over from Baltimore. Did you ever see such a hideous boulevard in your life?
I suppose there are boulevards just as terrible, but I'd never have seen any. No, no. It's a disgrace to humanity without question.
Why?
Well, because it represents the American lust for the hideous, the delight in ugliness for its own sake. It's very appropriately, it leads to the capital of the United States.
I remember you were using that phrase quite often when you wrote for the Sun papers, the American libido for the ugly.
Yeah.
That was a favorite topic.
Yeah. Well, the idea in that was this, that such horrible exhibitions are not due to mere ignorance and innocence. There is a positive delight in the ugly. If you go down the street in Baltimore in those endless rows of two-story houses on a summer night, you can look in them. They're usually illuminated more or less. And you notice you'll go sometimes for two or three blocks without seeing a single object that's not hideous. Not a single thing. Not even a picture on the wall or a carpet or a rug. Then all of a sudden, you'll see in even the meanest neighborhoods a house very tastefully decorated.
Such as your house at 1524 Holland?
No, mine is not one, but there is a colored woman that lived in the alley behind me who, in a little four-room house, did a swell job of decorating. I don't know who she was or what became of her. She finally disappeared. But she had this little house beautifully decorated with simple means. Cheap, but good. The color scheme was good, and the arrangement of things was good. Now, what that signifies, I don't know. I haven't the slightest idea.
Well, you were born in one of those two-story row houses, weren't you?
Yeah, I was born in Lexington Street in Baltimore near Fremont.
Mm-hmm. And you still live in one of those two-story houses?
No, it's three-story.
Three-story, well.
It was three-story, the one I was born into. My father bought the house I'm at present living in 1883.
That's a mark of great success in a Baltimorean when he's born in a two-story house and works up to live in a three-story house.
Yes, yeah, that is. But I had, unfortunately, didn't come up from that log cabin. My misfortune was that my father was relatively well off. It's been a curse to me all my life. Nobody will believe me on that ground. It seems to be the idea in America that no man is worth listening to unless he's had some experience in sweatshops. No, I'm all right.
What are your earliest recollections of Baltimore as a boy?
Well, I've written a book describing them. My first recollection is of the Oriole Parade in Baltimore. In 1883, I've been told by psychologists and other such frauds that you couldn't possibly recollect anything that early. I was 3 years old precisely. But I remember it. I recall it very distinctly. And it wasn't told to me. Baltimore, I knew as a boy, was extraordinarily hot in summer and filthy. Was full of flies, mosquitoes. All kinds of epidemics were running simultaneously. But the people liked it. Food was cheap. Houses were comfortable, although we slept under mosquito nets. And I look back on it with great affection. I realized its limitations. There were no sewers. Water supply was bad. Typhoid raged all summer, smallpox all winter, malaria at all times of the year. I had malaria, but I escaped typhoid and smallpox. How, I don't know. I think I escaped smallpox by a vaccination. The family doctor, old Dr. Wiley, vaccinated me when I was about 2 years old, and the scar was so enormous that it's still big as a half dollar on my arm, and no vaccination that I've ever had since has taken, as they say. I've been told that that's no proof of anything, but nevertheless, there is a fact.
What school did you go to?
I went to a school kept by an old German named Friedrich Knapp, known to Americans as Knapp. The school was down in Holiday Street, where the war memorial is now. And it was a private school. I went there till I was 12 years old, and then I went transferred to Polytechnic.
That's a high school.
Yeah. I never got beyond the Polytechnic. I graduated at the Polytechnic very early. I was only 15. And never went to school since, thank God. Most men that escaped college have a regret that pursues them. But I must confess I'm much too vain to have any such regrets. I think that what I was doing when the boys of my generation were in college, listening to idiot lectures and cheering football games and doing all the foolish and silly and useless things that college boys do, I was a young reporter on the street. And I believe...
How old?
18. I believe that a young newspaper reporter in a big city at that time led a life that has never been matched on earth for romance and interest.
Well, the general belief is that you were a born reporter, and I believe there's an interesting story as to how you got your first job.
No, the story's not interesting. I simply applied for it and got it. I never was a good reporter.
Well, you see, already there are legends. The legends are that you were offered to work for nothing and went out and came back with some big feature story.
No, I never got a scoop in my life. They were the things that were esteemed in those days. They never seemed to me to have any sense. Most scoops were bad stories, and they were always exaggerated and played up in an idiot manner. No, I wasn't a good reporter, except in one sense, that I worked. I was willing to work. I never shirked the job.
With what papers did you work?
I started with the Baltimore Herald, and that was the end of my experience as a reporter, because I became a Sunday editor very early, at 23, and a city editor right afterwards.
What paper?
Same Herald.
Same Herald.
And hence, I did very little reporting after... the age of 25. In later years, I went back to reporting as a kind of volunteer, but I did only things that were chosen by myself.
When did you begin your association with the Sun Papers?
1907, I should say. That's when the Herald blew up. I was then managing editor of the Herald, and the thing blew up under me. And I hear young reporters talking about the hazards of their life. I've been sold down the river 3 times in my life, and every time to my advantage.
Well, now, did you have a definite goal in view at the time you were working as a newspaper man?
No. I was so busy, I didn't have time to do any thinking. I wrote short stories, and when I was 20, I wrote a short story that attracted the attention of Ellery Sedgwick, later editor of the Atlantic Monthly. And Sedgwick took an interest in me, and in fact offered me a job on a magazine he was then editing in New York called Frank Leslie's Popular Monthly. I refused it, but Sedgwick and I became friends and have been friends ever since. Insofar as anybody discovered me, it was Ellery Sedgwick. I see him very seldom in late year, but we remain on very good terms.
Now, at a certain point, you established a beachhead in New York in what you might call literary circles and began commuting back and forth. How did you do that? How did that come about?
Well, in 1908, I think it was, I was offered a job of writing a monthly literary article for the Old Smart Set. That was one of many offers that I was getting in those days. I was getting them fairly well known among the magazines, and they suggested things for me to do. I took it, because it didn't involve going to New York. I disliked New York, and still do, and didn't want to go there. Didn't want to live there. And I wrote that article for 6 years. And then the Smart Set blew up when the war came on in 1914. And, through a complicated series of events that are not interesting, George Nason and I acquired control of the editorial department of it. He had been doing a little shorter than Wilde and I had an article on the theaters. And we ran the magazine as joint editors for 10 years. And it was very valuable to us. We had something that is a dream of every young writer. We had a magazine that we controlled and which printed everything we wrote without any interference by anybody else. It was an enormously valuable thing. Most of the stuff that I printed in the Smart Set in those days, and some of it attracted attention, could not have got into any other known magazine at that time. Well, in the end, we both got tired of it, and I did especially, and Smart Set had a bad title, which we couldn't change. It was short of money, and there wasn't any future in it. We had sucked out of it everything we wanted, so we decided to start another magazine, and we started the American Mercury, which was an enormously different magazine. The Smart Set was the most dreadful piece of printing in New York, and the American Mercury was the finest piece of printing that has ever been done in an American magazine. And, well, we lasted 10 years there, and I decided to quit. Because I've had a feeling all my life that 10 years is long enough for any job, that after that it gets more routinized, and the man really is tired of it, and had better clear out if he can.
Now, when you were associated with the Smart Set and the American Mercury, A great surge of vitality was taking place all through the literary world in America.
Yes.
The new writers were being discovered, some of them now famous.
Yeah.
And you had a great deal to do with that, you and Nathan.
Well, we did our share of it. We were always especially alert for young authors. We discovered, remember, a great many who never amounted to a damn. They disappeared in their time. I should say for 10 authors that we hooped along, not one survives today. But among the survivors are some very good men.
For instance?
Well, I wouldn't like to mention individuals for reasons plain enough. I might forget one who ought to be in the list. You know some of them.
Yes.
And I must say, I was always credited with more part in that than I really deserved. After all, you can't discover an author who is not good in himself. The most so-called discoverer does is to recognize the fact that the man is good. The man was good anteriorly. And nothing that the editor does helps him. I'm thoroughly convinced that editors don't help authors. Either a man is good or he's bad. And if he's good, he'll bust through in one way or another. If he's bad, no conceivable help will help him. For that reason, I don't believe in teaching writing.
Well, I was going to say that during the Smart Set and American Mercury phase, you were also quite active in the Sun, through that column, The Freelance, that appeared every Monday.
Part of that phase. I started The Freelance column in 1911 and gave it up in 1915, 4 years. It overlapped the Smart Set phase during those years. I was either literary critic of the Smart Set or editor all that time. But That column I gave up for various reasons. One thing, it was a burden. I had too many other enterprises, and doing a daily column was a very severe burden, and I began to get tired of it.
Well, you went back to that column after a lapse of years.
No.
Under another title?
No.
Didn't you?
After the First World War, when the kind of stuff that I was writing could be printed again, I went back to the Sun to write a weekly article.
That's what I meant.
That must have been in...
Monday article.
Yeah, it must have been in 1918 or 19, and I kept that up to... Oh, I kept it up 15 or 16 years, at least.
And it had a tremendous impact on the life of Baltimore, as you know.
I doubt it.
Well, I can speak from personal experience.
It may have had on you personally, but on the town as a whole, my opinion is that it hardly made a ripple.
Well, I was working as a reporter at the time, and I know that hardly a day went by, a week went by, when a bushel of letters didn't come in as a result of that Monday column. Letters usually calling you all kinds of names and disagreeing violently with everything you said, which was partly the object of the column.
The volume of mail that comes in to a magazine or a newspaper or a radio station is no index of anything, except that you happen to attract a lot of idiots, because most people that write letters to newspapers are fools. They're intelligent people seldom do it. They do it sometimes, but not often. I used to, in my days running a column, I welcomed the letters that came in and, in fact, edited them. I was in charge of the letter column and always let anybody that denounced me violently get in, because it was... I believe that people like to read abuse. And I didn't care what they said to me. I was much too vain to care what such idiots believed about me. In fact, I'd have been ashamed if they praised me. And so letters praising me very seldom got in that column.
Well, with uncharacteristic modesty, I think you're underplaying the influence of those Monday pieces on Baltimore. I came into the picture myself in 1920 as a young and somewhat starry-eyed reporter.
Yeah.
And at that time, and for the next 5 years, I mingled with the staff, with the underlings, and I know that you were regarded as a sort of a demigod, sort of a person up high up on Olympus who was in contact with all the literary greats, who was discovering novelists, who could have a novel published by a letter of recommendation and so forth.
I think you're describing an unusual situation that might be almost described as pathological.
Well,
the trouble with you
I shared that condition.
Yeah, the trouble with you is that you were an idealist. And you took that thing much too seriously, and certainly much more seriously than I did.
Many of the young men were idealists at that time.
Yeah, there were more of them. They were younger to begin with. Now you're an old man, just as I am, and I'm even older, and our idealism is out. Although I must say for myself that I never was an idealist.
It doesn't exist today among the younger members of the staff now. There's no such thing.
That's
the kind of spirit that we had, a kind of ambition, the kind
of... One of the things that puzzles me about the modern young newspaper man is, what does he do in his leisure? He has much more leisure than did in my time and yours. I worked all the time. He works 5 days a week. What does he do?
Well, one day he plays poker or plays golf, and the other day his wife drags him off to the movies. Or he stays home and minds the children while his wife goes out and plays bridge.
Well, all those things would have been considered not only degrading, but impossible psychologically in my time.
In 1920, most of us were bachelors, and as we would say now, wolves, playing around, very irresponsible, all of us shooting for the stars and falling short generally. Today, the majority of reporters, I think you'll find, are married and have small children and responsibility.
Yes, that's probably true, but the idea of a newspaper reporter with any self-respect playing golf is to me almost inconceivable. I hear that even printers now play golf. God almighty, that's dreadful to think of. I remember printers in my time. I knew a great many intimately. I always had to do with makeup on the papers, and hence I knew the printers. And I was very fond of them, and they were fine fellows. But golf playing would... It'd just seem as incredible as to hear of a printer going to a dance. Printers spent their leisure mainly in saloons, and in summer on the shores down the rivers below Baltimore. They were an intelligent man, the Goodwins. I learned a great deal more about the newspaper business from printers than I ever learned from editors. Great deal more. But now, when you hear of a printer going out and dressing himself up and playing golf, the thing is really obscene. It's dreadful to think of it.
Well, the New Deal certainly had its effect in newspaper offices.
Yeah.
When you were a young reporter, when I was a reporter, there was a great deal of freedom and camaraderie and low pay going with it and so forth. And long hours. I remember working from 1 o'clock in the afternoon till 11 at night, sometimes straight through. But the day the Guild
I did that every day.
Now we have a 40-hour week and so forth, and it has changed the whole characteristic, for better or for worse.
You could no more have a 40-hour week for a good newspaper reporter than you could have a 40-hour week for an archbishop. It's just not possible. A good reporter, he simply refuses to let a story go when he's got his teeth into it. And he wants assignments. I remember when I went down the office in the morning, the thing that interested me wasn't whether I'd get a lot of time off and go home early, but whether I'd get some good assignments. Mm-hmm. If I got the good assignments, I didn't care how long I worked. I've worked many a time all night. When the Baltimore fire happened in February 1904, I was a young city editor. They dug me out of bed about 11 o'clock in the morning. Said a big fire started downtown. I went downtown. I never got my clothes off or slept until Wednesday morning at 4 o'clock. That's from Sunday to Wednesday. I suppose that's almost a record for continuous work. I'd grant you that there were moments when I drowsed at my desk, but I never stretched out to sleep until Wednesday morning. And far from looking on that as oppressive or keeping an account of overtime, I was delighted with the opportunity. I was young, I was ambitious, and I liked the job. I get the impression from the modern reporter that he doesn't really like his work. He wishes he were a druggist.
Mm-hmm.
Or he wishes he had a good job.
Or a dramatist.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. The reporter with literary ambitions is one that I always respected. But most of the reporters that I encounter these days haven't even got literary ambitions. They never write anything outside the office.
Well, many a good reporter that we both knew has turned press agent.
Well, in my time, a press agent was looked on as a loathsome creature. Nobody paid any attention to him, and there was a rule on the Sun for many years that if a man ever became a press agent, he never could come back to the Sun.
Now he's a public relations counsel.
$15,000 a year. Yeah, he's just as bad as he was before. The thing that distresses me about press agentry is a simple one. I have seen so many good men become press agents of one kind or other, and there's a subtle corruption of their minds that they never get over. They simply can't recover from that horror. They're engaged in, if they're good journalists, some of them are. Remember, the worst men didn't become press agents, but often the best. And they know deep in their hearts that the thing is not a dignified trade. And they rationalize their necessities in one way or other, but they don't rationalize them enough to get rid of them. And
you've covered some very large and interesting newspaper stories in your day when you were acting independently and choosing your own assignments. I remember, for instance, the Scopes trial.
Oh.
That was a lot of fun.
Oh, it was a lot of fun.
With an overtone of tragedy, don't you think?
Yes, it was a dreadful thing to think of presumably civilized people falling into such a slough. And it was a dreadful thing to look at a man like Brian, a man with his opportunities in the world, to see what he had come to intellectually in his old age. It was a tragedy in a way, but I should add at once, it wasn't a tragedy to me. I wasn't suffering anything. I was enjoying it. I enjoyed it tremendously.
So who would not enjoy that remark, that famous remark of Brian? You remember?
What's that?
When he said that man is not a mammal?
Yeah. Well, I see nothing remarkable about that, because that is the belief of a very large section of the American people. If they're actually Christians, they can't believe that man's a mammal. Personally, I believe he is. But I have no particular horror of the man who believes it isn't. He seems to me an amiably comic character. Just like a man who believes that if you put a horsehair in a bottle of water, it'll turn into a snake. Or the man who believes that Friday is an unlucky day. I should add at once that I am one of those who do believe that Friday is an unlucky day. And like nearly all agnostics, I'm very superstitious. And I would no more undertake any work of importance on Friday the 13th than I'd jump off a house.
You are still an agnostic. You hold very faithfully to that.
Yeah. I was born an agnostic. My father was one ahead of me and his father ahead of him. So agnosticism is nothing new to me. I'll point out one of the strange corollaries, and that is this. A man who is an agnostic by inheritance, so that he doesn't remember any time that he wasn't, has almost no hatred for the religious. I get on very well with all kinds of ecclesiastics and all kinds of pious people, because I don't have any evil conscience in the matter. I'm not a renegade.
No feeling of sin.
No feeling of sin, whatever. I assume that they've got a right to believe anything they please. Being an extreme libertarian and believing in free speech and every other kind of freedom up to the last limits of the endurable. I think there is a limit beyond which free speech can't go, but it's a limit that's very seldom mentioned. It's the point where free speech begins to collide with the right to privacy. I don't think there are any other conditions in free speech. I've got a right to say and believe anything I please, but I haven't got a right to press it on anybody else. For example, take, for instance, the Catholic Church, which I am on good terms with personally, but have no belief in whatsoever. I've got a right to print my dissent from its doctrines, to utter them. I have exercised that right for many years. But I have no right to go on the cathedral steps on Sunday morning when the Catholics are coming out of High Mass and make a speech denouncing them. I don't think there is any such right. Nobody's got a right to be a nuisance to his neighbors.
Or to hurt his neighbors' feelings.
To hurt their feelings wantonly. If they come to him and say, "What do you think of this Mass we've just finished?" I think he has a right to answer. But he has no right to press his opinions on them. Well, of course, you'll notice the peculiar thing about the United States, where there is very little free speech. Free speech is a very limited right in this country, as I have learned to my better experience more than once. Yet it is a country where the right to press opinions on reluctant hearers is carried to a development that is unheard of on Earth. The whole country's full of propagandists who are bothering everybody all the time. I get in the mail every morning tremendous piles of propaganda of one kind or other. And I can easily imagine a man who would resent that, who would think it's a nuisance. And he ought to have some... There ought to be some way to save him from that annoyance. Personally, I don't care, because when I get propaganda and with it, there is one of those reply-played postal cards or envelopes, I always send it back empty, without any writing on it. They have to pay 3-4 cents to get it back, and it's my quiet way of saying that for you.
Do you remember the Battle of the Century? The great prize fight in Boyle's 30 acres between Dempsey and Carpentier?
Yes, I covered it. I covered it for the Baltimore Sun and the New York World. There was a very curious episode that fight. There were a lot of professional sports reporters there. They were all unanimously in favor of Carpentier for sentimental reasons. Dempsey, it appeared, had not been a war hero, and Carpentier had. And while it was plain to a child who looked at him that Carpentier couldn't conceivably beat Dempsey, why, these reporters, some of whom were very good, constantly sought during the fight for evidences of Carpentier making some impression on Dempsey. And in the 8th round, Carpentier happened to hit Dempsey, who staggered a bit, as a man will when he's caught off his balance, and the stories the next day, some of them, all were to the effect that Carpentier had nearly knocked out Dempsey. Well, I was innocent and ignorant, not being a sporting reporter, and I didn't mention any such episode. I mentioned the fact that he'd been hit him, but reported that he hadn't made any impression on him, whatever. This developed into a controversy. And some of the sporting professionals insisted that Dempsey had been staggered. And after the controversy went on for a week or two, it occurred to somebody to go to see Carpentier and Dempsey. And Dempsey's reply was that he hadn't felt the thing at all. And Carpentier's reply was that, so far as he knows, he hadn't made any impression on Dempsey whatsoever. That is a wonderful proof, of which there are many, that people believe what they want to believe. Now, the feeling against Dempsey at that fight was very bitter. And some of the sporting experts shared it. And another thing that I derived as a moral from the whole episode is this, that so-called experts are just ordinary men at bottom, and that you can't trust them, their judgment, in an emotional situation anymore. You can trust anybody else's.
Well, Dempsey went on, as you know, to live down his reputation as a draft dodger and became one of the most popular men in sports.
Later
on, I think we should say that in justice to Dempsey.
Oh, without doubt.
Has been a pretty decent...
There was nothing wrong with Dempsey.
He was badly managed.
He was badly managed. I know. I didn't hold anything against him on the ground that he wasn't a war hero. I wasn't myself.
But we don't want Dempsey misjudged 1,000 years from now when somebody plays back this record.
Well, naturally not. I think Dempsey later on kept a saloon in New York, which I often went into, which had good food and the best mint juleps ever served in New York. Old Edgar Lee Masters and I used to go in there and always drink a couple of those mint juleps. He charged $1 for them 15 years ago, and they were well worth it.
I don't think you'd better go on record as a mint julep drinker. Isn't beer your main...
I don't drink much beer. That's a legend.
I know, but I mean, haven't you always been a connoisseur of beer and a champion of beer as a drink?
Yes, I think beer is a cheap, excellent drink.
I mean, you were always making us thirsty during Prohibition by mentioning the better brand of European beer with which you were acquainted. I remember that distinctly.
I naturally, when I went abroad, drank the wine of the country. And if I was in Germany or Denmark, I drank beer. If I was in Italy, I certainly wouldn't drink beer, or Spain, or even France, although the German beers were always for sale in France. That was an exaggeration, my beer drinking. I'm actually ambibulous. I drink every known alcohol drink.
What was that word?
Ambibulous.
That's a very fine word.
I drink every known alcoholic drink and enjoy them all. And I've always learnt early in life how to handle alcohol and never had any trouble with it. The rules are as simple as mud. First, never drink if you've got any work to do. Never. If I've got a job of work to do at 10 o'clock at night, I wouldn't take a drink up to that time. Secondly, never drink alone. That's the way to become a drunkard. And thirdly, even if you haven't got any work to do, never drink while the sun is shining. Wait until it's dark. By that time, you're near enough to bed to recover quickly. I think the danger of alcohol largely consists of this. If a man starts to drink too early in the day or when he's got anything that puts a strain on him to do, as the alcohol goes out, or even while it's still in, he notices a letting down. No man can work as well with alcohol in him. He notices a letting down, and he's tempted to drink some more, which removes that feeling of being let down. And the result is he gets on a wheel, and he drinks too much. I am fond of drinking a reasonable amount. My doctor tells me that in his judgment, and he's one of the best doctors in America, alcohol to a man over 60 is not only harmless, but a positive benefit. He said it has an effect on the heart muscle that seems to be very salubrious, and that the man who drinks a moderate amount, at least according to my program, is not only not harmed, but benefited, which is good news to me.